Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. When Ohio became a state, seven Native American tribes lived on the land. The Shawnee, Wyandot, Miami, Delaware, Ottawa, Seneca, and Cayuga. But just 50 years later, they had vanished, forced to walk from their ancestral homes to Cincinnati, where they boarded boats for Oklahoma and beyond. It's a story that University of Cincinnati history professor Rebecca Wingo shares in a new podcast, The Ohio Country.
If you asked anybody in Cincinnati, did you know that the Wyandot Nation and Miami Nation, that they came here, boarded steamboats, and the last time they ever spent an evening in Ohio, in their home territory, was here in Cincinnati. Nobody would know. Nobody knows. But Cincinnatians at the time knew. And so when the Wyandot, for example, walked, they had horses and cattle and their wagons and everything they could possibly carry loaded onto those wagons and onto their horses. And they walked 150 miles from Upper Sandusky here to Cincinnati. Throngs of people lined the street to watch the last tribe leave. And so people are flooding the streets to see the last Indians in Ohio. That's what they call it. All of these newspaper articles are called the last Indians. And in throngs, so many people were lining the streets that the Wyandot couldn't even get through to the steamboats. They had to put police and guards on the riverbanks to keep people from walking onto the boat to see them leave, to just see, to touch, to understand, and to lament. And they were really of these two minds. They were like, this is very sad. This is the end of the race. But there was nothing to be done about it. This is manifest destiny. It's literally people believing that they have a right to be here and others do not.
Professor Wingo's story of the last Native Americans in Cincinnati is one of dozens being shared in WYSO's new podcast, The Ohio Country. Its episodes trace the history of tribes here in Ohio, what was lost when they were forcibly removed, and what we can all gain from helping them reclaim their history. Chris Welter produced The Ohio Country along with Nina Ellis. And Chris joins us here now. Welcome to All Sides.
Hey, thanks.
You know, viewed through a modern lens, it seems almost unfathomable that we would have packed up a whole race of people and shipped them off to another part of the country. And yet, that's exactly how it happened.
Yeah, that is exactly what happened. And it was a process that took quite a long time. And it was a process that was not approved by everyone in Ohio. I think that's really important to note. Andrew Jackson's Indian removal policy was voted against by 11 of the 13 Ohio congressmen at the time. And, the Wyandot and the Miami and these other, nations of people were really important in their communities in Ohio. I mean, they were in a lot of ways assimilated. They had, farmland, they had fenced in properties, they had built homes that were more kind of European style. So there were a lot of people in the communities that didn't want them to leave, right, because they were neighbors and friends. But it became a situation where the federal government decided that they had to be removed and that the land that they had would be better suited for other settlers. So it's a really tragic history, but it's also a story of resilience, I think, for the tribes today, because they still exist, and lots of them are based in Oklahoma, and they've overcome this difficult history, and now they're coming back to Ohio.
So this project was nearly 2 years in the making for you, and hundreds of miles on your car traveling to Oklahoma. Yeah. Why did you and Nina decide that this was a story that needed to be told?
Yeah, so we were approached by the Ohio Humanities, and they told us, hey, we have some grant money, and we think that this is a really important story to be told. And our original reaction was, boy, this is going to be difficult. This is a lot of history. This is 200, 300 years in the past. What is the tape that we can use? We're thinking about the audio. But they said, okay, like take a couple of months, read a couple of books. And we quickly learned about the modern initiatives going on throughout the state of Ohio, the things that the Ohio History Connection was doing, the things that the Ohio Department of Natural Resources was doing. And we said, and then we also learned about all of these folks that live in Ohio today that are doing this work, these modern day Native American people. And so we said, yeah, we think this is a story that needs to be told and hasn't gotten the kind of coverage that it warrants, because really for the last, there have always been Native American people in Ohio, but I would say for the last 25 years, specifically the tribes that have a historic connection to Ohio have been working with agencies in the state on a variety of initiatives. And so, a lot of that has kind of not been covered and hasn't been told. And then, the history also of the last 250 years in Ohio, the Native American history has really not been told in a way that, that presents Native American people as living, breathing people and communities today. So we also thought that was really important. And especially after going down to Oklahoma multiple times, going to Minnesota, Indiana, to, because there's no tribes within our borders today in the state of Ohio to meet these folks, we realized that, yeah, it's really important for us to, to teach the people in Ohio a little bit about, what these communities are like today and to really just reinforce that they're living communities today.
You can find the Ohio Country Podcast anywhere you get them, Apple, Spotify, all those great places. 7 of the 12 episodes are out. And one of the things I've really been enjoying in listening to the podcast is expanding our understanding of American history and learning that some of the things that we've been taught maybe were not quite accurate. You talk a lot about Blue Jacket. It was a long-running outdoor theater production here in Ohio, which closed in 2007. And it's based on a now controversial book called The Frontiersman by Alan Eckerd. Can you tell us how it went from fact to fiction?
Yeah, sure. So I think when we talked about removals to start, when you remove an entire community of people, multiple communities that have so much history here, including the Shawnee and the Eastern Shawnee and the Absentee Shawnee, what is left is this vacuum. And you have people like Alan Eckerd who came in and, they did, Alan Eckerd did do, the author of The Frontiersman, did do legitimate historical research, but he also fabricated a lot of things to make it a more compelling novel, a fiction novel. And that's, there was no one pushing back on that, right? The Shawnee communities were in Oklahoma. When the time he was writing this, there was no internet. It was difficult for them to drive 1,000 miles to come back and kind of push back against these falsehoods. And specifically with Blue Jacket, the biggest falsehood is that, Alan Eckerd promoted this theory that Blue Jacket was actually a white man. The Shawnee
taken by the Shawnee
and became, Chief Blue Jacket. And the Shawnee have always known that was false. I mean, we're going to talk with Talon Silverhorn later this hour. Talon Silverhorn is a Blue Jacket, right? Like is related to, and his family and their community have always known that that's not the case. But it really took until, 2006 when researchers at Wright State actually did the genetic research and proved without a doubt that Blue Jacket was not a white man named Van Swearingen from Indiana. So that's one example, but there's also just been a lot of other bad and kind of stereotypical history. And I think that just happens when you don't see a community of people, when you don't see Shawnee people, Miami people, and Wyandotte people, and you're not asking them their perspective, and you're seeing them as something of the past, it's a lot easier to create these falsehoods and to spread them through, our school system and also through these outdoor dramas that were attended by millions of people.
You traveled to Oklahoma for this podcast, which is where the Eastern Shawnee tribe is located. And you spent a lot of time with Chief Glenna Wallace.
Yeah.
She's an 85-year-old leader of the tribe, and she's really invested her life's work in rebounding both financially, emotionally, and culturally. And yet, as she says on the podcast, 400 of the 542 Eastern Shawnee residents in Ottawa Township live below the poverty line.
Statistics are quite readily available for natives in the United States. We have the highest suicide rate. We have the highest dropout rate from high school. We have the highest dropout rate from college. We have the lowest entry into college. We have negative statistics that that define us and that we just simply must work upon.
I wonder, does Glenna Wallace, Chief Glenna Wallace that we just heard from, does she see a correlation between eviction from their homeland and these statistics?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's not only the eviction from the homeland, but it's the subsequent, forced assimilation in boarding schools, which we'll get into in further episodes in the podcast. And it's also just the reality of where they were sent, right? Your homelands in Oklahoma is a very different environment than Ohio was, the Shawnee.
Different soil, different climate.
Yeah. Different economic industries. And, I should say that, northeastern Oklahoma is a poor area, but the eastern Shawnee are very present there. They have a lot of a variety of businesses. They do have casinos, but they also own a number of banks. They have a shooting range. They have a variety of diversified business, and all the tribes, the Miami, the Wyandotte, all have these things too. And so, they really see, actually, for Chief Glenna, I would say I'll speak for her, but she sees the opportunity for Shawnee people to come back to their homelands in Ohio as really a way to sort of address some of these issues, right? That was what was so cool about when Great Council State Park opened down near Xenia in June, was there were 100 Shawnee people here that traveled up by bus or by plane to see the opening of this park that had been created in collaboration with their tribes and the state of Ohio. And this was the first time that they had a place to come back to in Ohio that they could, feel proud of, right? They're not going to come back to a live action performance of Blue Jacket where there's people in red face and they're saying that their ancestor is a white man. No, you're going to come back to a museum that, was created in collaboration with the leaders of your tribe and tells a much more accurate and holistic history. So I think that absolutely the removals and the subsequent, boarding schools and forced assimilation have created the issues that the Eastern Shawnee face today in Oklahoma and their citizens. But they're working really hard, and all of these tribes, the money that they generate from their businesses, they're putting back into their communities in a variety of ways, through healthcare initiatives, through, food programs, through education initiatives. So it's really pretty cool to see the ways that you can, help kind of all these different historic Ohio nations are supporting their communities today through their economies.
Yeah, we had Chief Glenna Wallace on earlier this year when the Ohio Earthworks was designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And that's something she's also spent a lot of time working on here. And one of the things she talked about in the podcast, which I really thought was so well put, she talked about the toll leaving Ohio has had on members of the tribe more than two centuries later.
Once your people have lived in a land and they're no longer there, that doesn't mean your heart has left that land. Your feet might have. That doesn't mean your heart has. And that kind of describes what I will always have a place in my heart for Ohio. And our first trip back, it seemed like every place we went, it rained. And it rained, but it wasn't a harsh rain. And somebody asked me how I felt about it. And I said, I think it's a gentle rain because we've had so much resentment and we've had so much pain that's been caused to us by Ohio, that it has to be gentle to begin to remove some of that bitterness and remove that resentment and be able to be friendly with people and talk about the situation there. And another lady, then she looked at me and she said, that's a beautiful thought, but she said, I think when it starts raining on us, she said, I think that's our people in heaven who are so happy seeing us to have returned. That's their tears of happiness coming down. Those thoughts have always stayed with me, and I feel that way.
I don't know. Yeah. It really gets you right in the gut.
Yeah, it's, I think it's important to note that, the removals are like 175 to 200 years ago. The Shawnee have been here for, well over 15,000 years. And so to give that sort of perspective about how many generations had lived in Ohio, it really is kind of just a blip, this absence they have. So I really, you know, after doing this podcast, I can sympathize with what Chief Glenna says. And I've also seen the way that these, you know, Chief Glenna organized these bus tours back to Ohio. And what they were is they were cultural bus tours where she would have 100 to 200 Shawnee citizens that would go around the state, and they would see the earthworks, and they would basically see, they saw the good and the bad of how they were being represented in Ohio. And a lot of people were inspired by those trips. You know, Talon Silverhorn, who we're going to have on later, will be. Laura Day, who is a poet, wrote a book about the experience that we're going to talk a lot about in the next episode. So these opportunities to reconnect with the culture in Ohio, I've heard from, you know, like at least a dozen Shawnee people that it really did change their lives and help them feel connected with their Shawnee identity and heritage. So yeah, I'm really glad we've been able to show that. And I'm really glad that now there's more opportunities for Shawnee and Miami and Wyandotte people to come back to Ohio and stay here and work here, you know, with things related to the earthworks and, you know, working for the Department of Natural Resources, the Ohio History Connection. I think that's a really cool thing. And I'm glad that that's where we're at.
Coming up, we're going to talk with Talon Silverhorn, a member of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe, on the importance of Ohio's newest state park. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about the history of Native Americans in Ohio. There's a new podcast, The Ohio Country, which traces their stories, seeking to help complete our picture of how our state was settled. Still with us is Chris Welter, a producer of the new YSO podcast, The Ohio Country. And joining us now is Talon Silverhorn, a citizen of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe, who grew up on the Shawnee Reservation in Oklahoma. He's a descendant of the famous Shawnee Chief Blue Jacket, and he now works for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources and is the cultural program manager for our newest state park. Welcome to All Sides, Talon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great Council State Park is Ohio's newest park. It's located in the Old Town area of Xenia, and it seeks to celebrate and to honor the history of Native Americans in Ohio. Talon, how'd you get involved with its construction?
I started on the project a few years ago on sort of the historical consultation side of things, sort of giving some input, doing a little bit of background research on the site. I was still living in Virginia, working as a historical interpreter for the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. And, you know, as the project began to grow, was made clear that there was going to be a full-time role that someone would need to fill and actually looking after, you know, sort of the development of this content and the way that it would be presented to the public. So I packed up and moved from Virginia to Ohio and have been here about 4 years.
What's the significance of locating it in Old Town in Xenia?
So this was the site of Old Chillicothe, a Shawnee village of about 1,200 people from 1777 to August of 1780. And this site, the 14 acres that we now own here and protect, you know, our goal is to study this place, is to interpret the history of Shawnee people that were living here, and to help people sort of connect with, you know, the future of Shawnee people that are, you know, living here in this site in the 1700s, and then tracing the steps from here all the way to Oklahoma and helping people connect with our contemporary community.
There's a 12,000 square foot interpretive center that's modeled after a historic Shawnee longhouse. There's also a short film that you can watch in the theater. What has it meant to you to have this kind of state park in this location?
You know, I think this is really great. This is something that is, I think, unique. We don't really see anything else of this sort of scale investment that really focuses on, you know, our tribal communities. Oftentimes we're a footnote in other interpretive sites and places. We are maybe one paragraph in a panel in a nature center, right alongside the other flora and fauna of the area. But this is a place that really centers our tribal community and allows, you know, an opportunity and a platform for our Shawnee citizens to reconnect with not only their homelands, but really specifically an ancestral site where so much of this history is kind of centered. So I think this is great.
We're talking with Talon Silverhorn this hour, a member of the Shawnee tribe and cultural program manager for our newest state park, Great Council State Park. I want to bring in something from episode 2 of the Ohio Country Podcast. It's where Governor Mike DeWine talks about the importance of the park in helping Ohioans understand the legacy of the tribes that once lived here.
This really is focused on a relatively short period of time, 1777 to 1780. And it's a fascinating period of time because it is the intersection of our European American settlers coming in, Native Americans here, sometimes in battle, sometimes in peace, but those two forces really, really coming together. One of the stories I think we hear about from the settlers' point of view is when Daniel Boone was captured by Shawnees and brought right here and lived here for 6 months, was adopted by the chief, and went out on hunting parties and did all kinds of things, and then at some point after about 6 months decided he was out and made it back to Boonesboro. So you just imagine Daniel Boone here. You imagine, you know, Tecumseh, as we think as a young boy, was here. So it's just, it is the coming, really coming together of all of this.
You know, Chris, I, as I'm sure you do, knew about Tecumseh, knew about Daniel Boone.
Yeah.
And there are so many stories and myths about both of them. Mm-hmm. What has surprised you most in putting together the Ohio Country Podcast?
Well, you know, I think Talon can talk about this too. Everyone seems to have a story. Everyone seems to have a story about that time period. You know, this is the tree where Tecumseh used to tie his canoe, or this is...
I grew up in New England, and so many places are like, George Washington slept here, and they'd have that little marker outside.
Yeah, it's like that, and you know, that's fine, but a lot of times I don't think people actually have maybe spent the time to really learn about what Tecumseh was advocating for, sort of the era that he was in, and the things that he did. You know, Tecumseh, I think, is oftentimes portrayed as just a warrior, and he was so much more than that. So that's what I think has been most interesting to me, is just, you know, hearing how the perception of Tecumseh amongst people that have lived in Ohio a long time, and then comparing that to the perception of Tecumseh from people like Talon and other Shawnee folks.
Yeah, Talon, I want to say I've heard Tecumseh described as a Native American Napoleon, or conversely, as a reluctant warrior who felt he had no other choice. Why do you think we here in Ohio mythologize his life so much?
Well, I think it allows, there's a lot of Native characters that end up being mythologized. They're sort of separated from their larger community and sort of lifted, you know, into this elevated position of, you know, prominence within the American mind. I think oftentimes it has to do with how Americans choose to tell stories and sort of the values that are ascribed in American storytelling. So these people like Tecumseh and the Prophet, Little Turtle, Blue Jacket, Sitting Bull, you know, Black Elk, Seattle, Pontiac, they kind of become martyrs to the American sort of storytelling tradition, where they become these great adversaries or these sort of super virtuous opponents. that are ultimately defeated. And it is a bittersweet thing, you know, in the American storytelling tradition to see, you know, such a virtuous enemy fall. But it also is a reminder of the divine right of conquest. I think it is a lot easier for people to epitomize what they know about and what they think about a sort of other community into one person, rather than trying to comprehend the community as a whole, which is why so much of what I do in my interpretation is sort of decentralize the hero narrative, right? This is not a battle of heroes. This is, you know, a sort of struggle of community and ideology and sort of personhood on the individual level, right? So I think that's why it has to do a lot with how Americans have historically told stories, centering their values or sort of the other values into these concentrated ingots, which become these characters, these heroes, which is why we have so many individualized legends around these people like Daniel Boone, Simon Kenton, Tecumseh, and why their names have overshadowed the larger communities that they come from.
Yeah, I used to live out in Oregon, and there was the myth of the Chief Seattle speech. It's supposed to be this bittersweet call for respecting Native American rights and environmental values. And the Oregonian at one point did this like investigative deep dive into it and discovered that like this is not a speech that he gave. It did not actually exist. It was written after his death by a white guy who thought it sounded good. And it's so fascinating to me that we take that idea of the Chief Seattle speech or who Blue Jacket was, and we just accept that as truth for so very long.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it even happens, you know, within our own tribal communities, you know, and for a long time, I think our tribal communities have been willing to kind of accept these legends in a very positive way, that they have been, in some cases, the only good representation, you know, that has been around. A lot of the historical fiction that, you know, was very popular for, you know, previous generations was some of the only good representation of our tribal communities. But, you know, we have so much more available to us now that I think it's time to sort of let these fictions go.
Chris, one of the things I appreciated about the Ohio Country podcast is you freely admit that your station, WYSO, has sometimes fallen for some of these legends that may or may not be true.
Yeah, we absolutely have. And, you know, I've appreciated the feedback that, you know, folks like Talon have given us and their willingness to really kind of like walk us through and help provide us with, you know, primary source documentation. Yeah, I mean, I listen back to some of the stuff that our station WYSO has, the way we've reported on Native American people, and I really do cringe. But we're making more of an effort now to establish relationships with citizens of the federally recognized Shawnee and other tribes, and I think our reporting is just so much better now. It's less stereotypical. We're not, you know, presenting the heroic narrative anymore. And I really hope that and I know this is the fact because I've seen, you know, you all have had Chief Glenn on. A lot of other media publications are starting to do a better job of, you know, getting the right sources and putting good history out there. So I hope that, you know, all media outlets in Ohio will reflect on sort of some of the bad history they promote in the past and that we can, you know, improve that by, you know, speaking with people like Talon and people like Chief Glenna.
Yeah. One of the topics you tackle is something that we had a debate over here in Ohio, and that is the naming of the Wayne National Forest. Mm-hmm. It is named after General Mad Anthony Wayne, more than 200 years after he tried to eradicate indigenous people. So it is, we're having this very real conversation about what do we call the Wayne National Forest.
Yeah, we sure are. And, you know, we speak with Chief Ben Barnes of the Shawnee tribe about that a little bit. And, you know, he essentially says that, you know, Ohio is a diverse place today and that, you know, a better suited name would be Buckeye National Forest or Pawpaw National Forest. And, you know,
who's going to hate Buckeye National Forest?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's pretty
it's a good name to pick
easy.
If you want to.
Pawpaw is good, too. You know, that, you know, there's the Pawpaw Festival every year. It's a really cool, you know, fruit that grows extremely well here in Ohio. We have huge pawpaws. And so, you know, the all of the, you know, tribal nations that have historic ties to Ohio, or most of them in Oklahoma, you know, all kind of signed on a paper asking for the name to be changed. And so now it's kind of just it's in the, I believe, the United States USDA's hands, and it's kind of been paused for a moment. But yeah, it has become very, very political. And I think a lot of the kind of more conservative lawmakers that have written notes, you know, or written letters with concern, I think that the way that they're viewing history is sort of through a certain lens. And so they're viewing Anthony Wayne as this hero and this, you know, patriot. But I think if you look at history from a more holistic view, you can see why you maybe wouldn't want to name an entire state park that really has no actual connection to this man after that. And I should also say there's lots of places that are already named after Wayne in Ohio. So it's
Wayne
not
County?
Like Wayne County, there, you know, Fort Wayne in Indiana. So it's not like we're going to – Anthony Wayne's history, we're not – and in the podcast, we're not trying to erase that history. You know, we're not trying to erase the history of pioneers or of people from that era, but we're just trying to, you know, tell a more holistic version.
Yeah, you give a really more complete picture of Anthony Wayne, too. You talk about his skill as a military leader, but you also talk about his bouts of depression, his erratic behavior, that both he and President George Washington don't actually think they're going to be able to remove the Native American tribes from Ohio.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we were just, you know, we were trying to present Anthony Wayne, and we had George Ironstrack, who's a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma and works at the Miamia Center at Miami University. And, you know, his ancestors were some of the people that negotiated with Wayne during the Treaty of Greenville in 1795 in what's now Dark County, Ohio. And, you know, I don't think that we present Wayne as a villain. I think we present him as, you know, what he was. He was a
complicated human.
A complicated human of his time. So, yeah, I hope that people that listen to it don't think that we're trying to sort of, you know, totally erase one part of history. But I think you can gain more and learn more from history when you look at it from a holistic point of view, and you have the perspective of both the early Americans, but also of the Miami and Shawnee and other folks that were there at that time.
Talon, it kind of sounds like what you were describing about Tecumseh and some of the other mythologies. It's about maybe taking these people from myth to human.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, in sort of the American storytelling tradition, you know, we tend to epitomize, you know, virtues, right and wrong, and conflicts on either side, kind of concentrate them into figures, you know, of prominence. Washington, Napoleon, Wayne, Little Turtle, Blue Jacket, you know, and we tend to sort of play with them as action figures. You know, we tend to kind of move them around in representation of the values of their communities, or how we perceive the values of their communities. But often we kind of miss the forest for the trees when we do that.
One of the things I enjoyed is in episode 3, Talon, you are shown traveling the country, essentially, and you're demonstrating how to make maple sugar. And it's something that you do quite a bit, right? You do flint knapping and moccasins and arrows. How important has that been to your life's work?
That's been very important. You know, the traditional skills and material culture, you know, that's something that I'm very passionate about. And I think they are oftentimes sort of gateways to deeper understandings. You know, when we do things like tapping trees, or, you know, when we make hunting implements, these are all kind of distillations of larger cultural values and networked systems and living systems. So, you know, we can't truly appreciate those material items without having a good understanding of the sort of broader cultural identity that made those things possible in the first place, and how they fit into, you know, the other end of the system. So making, say, for example, a set of arrows, I need to understand the ecology of the forest and where to get, you know, my materials. I need to have an existing relationship with, you know, the sort of plants and animals that I need for bindings and for glue, for feathers, you know, the stone that I'm going to use for tools, say like the points, for example. And then also the cyclical practices that are embodied in those things. So making sugar, making arrows, making moccasins, tanning leather, doing other forms of stonework or copper, working with traditional materials, I think is a really good way to reconnect with traditional practices and sort of traditional mindsets or seasonal life. It's also a really great way to sort of build learning plans for our tribal community and getting people reconnected. So that's another big goal of mine, is to sort of translate these traditional skills into a more land-based, learning opportunity for our tribal communities, and hopefully reconnect a bit more with our homelands.
Do you have any plans, or would you like to offer some of these classes at Great Council State Park?
I think that would be great. I would love to see something along the lines of a tribal internship here at Great Council, where we bring, 5 to 10 students a year, allow them a few weeks to work here, essentially, to, be a part of Great Council, to learn about this ancestral site, to learn about the life ways of their ancestors here on the land where it actually took place, do some research, go and visit some collections and understand, how to build relationships with these existing sort of systems that are, holding on to ancestral objects, that are caring for ancestral sites, learning to sort of work within the system that, is present here, and, building conversations around how best, to get into this field, historic preservation and interpretation, curation, and just museum work in general. I think it's really been my hope that we can reframe the idea of being a native museum professional away from just sort of static preservation, right? And sort of curating our cultural practices as a static a dead thing that needs to be preserved, but really revitalizing, using these spaces like Great Council and like other state historic sites and whatever, as places where we can show cultural revitalization progress. We can bring a more contemporary and more future focused sort of view to this. And I think having tribal people come to Great Council and other places like it are a really important part of that, where our people have the opportunity to reconnect with their ancestral sites, and the people that are living here now in Ohio, that diverse community, say that Chief Barnes was talking about, have the opportunity to meet our Shawnee people, not just our leaders and politicians at a distance, but the people themselves sitting down, cup of coffee, working on something together, and really rebuilding community.
That's Talon Silverhorn of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. Coming up, we're talking indigenous agricultural practices in Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded Podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about a new podcast from WYSO. It's called The Ohio Country, and it traces the history of Native Americans here in Ohio, their expulsion, and their return to the land, including the opening of Great Council State Park here in Xenia. I want to talk a little bit about agriculture. And Chris, Chris Welter, a producer of the YSO podcast, is still with us. One of your episodes that really struck me is with Jeremy Turner. He's a member of the tribe from Indiana, and he describes how Shawnee farmed and how he teaches these practices to others in the Midwest today.
Yeah, you know, Jeremy does a lot of historic interpretation work similar to what Talon does, but he has a farm in outside of Indianapolis where he does a lot of the sort of traditional practices, and he has a lot of the seeds that have been, you know, planted on the land here for, you know, thousands, hundreds, if not thousands of years. And, you know, I think what I was really wanting to show with that was to show in some ways the, you know, how sustainable these practices were, how they could be used on, you know, kind of a garden scale, but also on a larger scale that allowed both for sort of like sustenance agriculture, but also kind of you could produce excess and trade it. And it was really a, you know, ingenious system that, you know, utilized, you know, fire as a way to sort of, you know, burn fields and sort of replenish the nutrients, and then also used the intentional kind of damming of floodplains, like they would let the beavers, you know, flood the fields, and then that would also add nutrients. And also just kind of similar to what some farmers do today, there was a constant process of, you know, cycling from field to field and moving your communities, because when the soil became depleted, it wasn't worth it really. And so I think a lot of the sort of, you know, regenerative farming is such a big buzzword today, but these things have been being done for a long time, these sustainable practices. And so it's been, it was really cool to talk to Jeremy. My colleague Alejandro Figueroa went to Indiana. He was our former food and agriculture reporter, and talked to Jeremy. And I know I learned a lot from that episode too, just about, you know, the way things have been done here for a long time and kind of, you know, some of the early initiatives to have those things happen again here in Ohio.
Still with us also is Talon Silverhorn, a member of the Eastern Shawnee tribe who now works for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. And Talon, you know, I moved back to Ohio in the winter of 2019, and I read this book, The Pioneers, it describes the settling of Ohio by white settlers, but it also describes the landscape of Ohio when the first white people arrived. And they talk about these trees that are so large that they touch each other across the Ohio River. And they talk about all these animals and old growth forests. And I'm like, where the heck is all this stuff? Because the landscape described in that book is not at all how Ohio looks today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the things that kind of impacts our view of you know, our traditional landscape is the idea of this pristine wilderness, right? And I think sometimes there's a little exaggeration to be had in these stories of, you know, the landscape before settlement. But in some cases, it really is true. I mean, there are these vast forests that are sort of well-managed. There are these vast sort of prairie areas that are cycled through and burned and kept fallow. You know, there are, and I think the part that I think everyone sort of misses out on, or the part that went over a lot of these early settlers' heads, is the idea that this is not wilderness. This is extremely human-managed land. You know, the places that they're looking at, those forests are only possible, you know, really with consistent human interaction, you know, clearing of the underbrush and burning, you know, debris, keeping things clear, you know, sort of promoting the growth of trees that, you know, are more human beneficial, a bit more permacultural lifestyle. So there was a presentation that I gave for the Ohio Botanical Symposium called The Roots of Culture, that talked about the development of, or the co-development of tribal cultures and identity and the landscape itself from the end of the last glacial maximum 12,000 years ago. And the data shows that, you know, for the last 12,000 years or so, more than three quarters of the Earth's surface has been manipulated by humans. And that's true here in North America as well. You know, our landscape and the people that inhabit it have been developing together as relatives, as siblings, you know, for quite a long time. And so the idea of this pristine wilderness, you know, with the trees so large that you can carve your entire house out of them, and you know, rivers so clear that you can see, you know, 20 feet down. There is some truth to that, in that exaggeration, you know, but the truth is that these are human managed areas, and that pristine environment is only possible with proper stewardship.
Yeah, old growth forests were definitely logged much more heavily here than by the time we get out to Oregon and California. Eventually, we sort of realized maybe we shouldn't do that. But You know, one of the things I found really fascinating about the podcast, Chris, is you have this example of the Huffman Prairie at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And it's supposed to look the way Ohio prairies looked before settlement and colonization. And how can you share a little bit about how White Pat was convinced to maintain this as prairie land?
Yeah, it's somewhat random. And most of the sort of remnant prairie and savanna that exists today in Ohio it's mostly because it was farmland that the farmers decided to just use as a grazing pasture for their cattle. So it was never sort of tilled up and, you know, the deep prairie roots were maintained and were still intact. And then the thing that's unique about Huffman Prairie is that, of course, the Wright brothers rented this land from the farmer and, you know, the first ever flight was done. I know that North Carolina likes to claim that, but the first actual flight was done right there. And then, you know, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, you know, then becomes, you know, they're not going to farm the land because it's right next to, you know, these hangars. And so basically, by kind of just the random luck, they decided to just continually mow this prairie, which in some ways kind of replicated the disturbance that fire would do to it. And then Dave Nolan, who, you know, Talon presented with in April about fire stewardship, who is kind of a legend in the Dayton area conservationist, he spoke to the base and he said, hey, we should start resuming burns here, because this was in the 80s when there was a lot of concern about a lack of remnant prairies, because these prairie plants, a lot of Ohio's rare insects and birds and plants, they need to have good prairies. So he convinced them to resume burning. And now there's a really robust burning program going on there that the United States Air Force endorses, and they bring in people from around the country to do these burns. They do it, you know, at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. And it's created this really rich kind of 100-acre prairie. And there's a lot of plants and animals and bugs there that can only be found at that prairie. And a lot of the prairies that are kind of being restored across the state, they're getting the seeds from that place. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, the United States government comes in and bans burning and fire, but then all these years later, now they're sort of, you know, the United States Air Force is endorsing and is conducting these burns because they realize the value of it.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about biodiversity here on this podcast and about the importance of planting native plants. I mean, anybody who's had to deal with invasive honeysuckle or any of those others here know just how pain in the butt it is to try and get rid of the stuff that doesn't have any natural enemies.
It was cool with, you know, being with Dave Nolan, the conservationist, at a burn and, you know, seeing the prairie burn and seeing these autumn olive and these really difficult invasive plants just being like burnt away. And it made him so happy as a conservationist, these really challenging plants, to just see how fire kind of just, you know, destroys them. And then, you know, they don't pop back up as bad. And the native plants, because they're fire dependent and their seeds actually germinate better after they've been exposed to fire, they're the ones that come back up in that new growth. So it's a really cool process.
Yeah. Jeremy Turner also mentioned that the Shawnees still have hunting and trapping rights here in Ohio and other states. And he talked about that desire for tribal members to return here. I want to play a quick clip before we run out of time this hour.
It's good for our Mother Earth. Living in unison with it and you know, cohabitating in a way that does not destroy the earth and harm it any further than has already been done is the way of the future. That's the only way that we will, you know, be able to be here in another 1,000 years. Otherwise, you know, the way that we're living today is very destructive. And, you know, if we keep it up, we may not last 1,000 years, you know, and this earth may be destroyed by then.
Talon, I want to ask you one final question. Where do you see the future of Native American tribes in Ohio? What does the next 1,000 years look like?
That's something that I think about a lot. You know, I want to see this road that's been developed. I would say, you know, for the last 20 or 30 years, there's sort of been this path being trodden between Oklahoma and Ohio and Pennsylvania, you know, and our historic homelands. I think I would love to see more programs like what's at Miami University, the Miamia Center, more programs like that to help tribal students reconnect with these homelands, and have a cultural-based education at these Ohio universities. I would love to see more land-based learning programs that help tribal community members reconnect with historic homelands, more protected areas for our heirloom crops, which are meant to grow in these regions, that can be used for our purposes in Oklahoma. So I would love to see, even though, you know, we live in Oklahoma today, that is our home, our life, our culture, our songs, our language, our religion, everything lives with the people. It's not necessarily tied to the place, but it is hard to do some of these things and maintain some of these ways of life when for, you know, the last 3,000 or 4,000 years, it's, you know, so I would love to see stronger connection being built. And I think it's happening. And Great Council is proof of that.
That was Talon Silverhorn of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And thank you to Chris Welter.
Thanks, Anna.
Producer of the Ohio Country Podcast.